We turn now to Syria, where thousands of refugees have fled across the northern border into Turkey. They're escaping an increasingly violent situation there. For months, the Syrian regime has been clashing with protesters who've been in the streets, demanding that President Bashar al-Assad step down. The violence reached a tipping point this week in the town of Jisr al-Shakur. The government says security forces were sent in to restore order, but a Syrian farmer said those forces are causing the chaos.
Today, I come close to the Jisr al-Shakur and I see soldiers go into the homes.
معي صور بتأكد هالشي.
I have some pictures that show it is true.
قاموا بهدم قريتين. هدم كامل.
Two villages are collapsed.
قرية عرفنا عنها أنه مات فيها أربعة والناس نزحت للحدود والقرية الثانية ما معروف عنها شيء.
One of them, one of the villages, all the people in the village leave the village and come to the border. And we don't know nothing about the second.
That Syrian farmer fled across the border into Turkey today. That's where we reached BBC reporter Owen Bennett-Jones.
I'm looking over into Syria. It's about less than a kilometre away from here. And there are some olive groves on the other side of a road which forms the frontier. I can see in those olive groves what has emerged over the last few days, a makeshift campsite in which hundreds of people are processed every day. And just about 20 minutes ago, there was a remarkable scene down there because someone obviously had died and there was a coffin which was produced from these tents. And suddenly there were hundreds of people moving across the fields, gathering in the centre of some orchards. And there they obviously said their obsequies for this person who died, and then the crowd eventually scattered. It was a remarkable scene in the middle of a very rural place with olive groves, as I say, wheat fields, cattle, sheep. And then in the midst of this, these people all on the move, unsettled, fleeing their homes, fleeing the violence.
Owen, can you give us a sense of the scale of the refugee crisis at this point, if we can call it a crisis? We've heard numbers ranging from 3,000 to 4,000 people fleeing from Syria into Turkey. What's your estimation?
I've just spoken to an official from the Foreign Ministry, and he said it was 4,300 is the latest official number. But these are the people who've been registered. There will be many more who've managed to get in without the army knowing, and they are staying with relatives and friends in the communities here.
Have you been able to get out to the camps and talk with these Syrian refugees?
The authorities are blocking access to the camp, so it's actually quite difficult to get to the refugees. But I did meet one man this morning who had some very interesting testimony. He fled yesterday. He woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning in his village near Jisr al-Shakur, the place which is being so fiercely contested in Syria at the moment, about 10 miles away from me now. And he woke up to hear tank fire. He looked out of his house and the neighbouring village is below him, he said, on a hillside. And it was being entered by tanks and troops. He said they fired on all the buildings. They killed people, he didn't know how many. And then when they left, they fanned out the troops into the wheat fields and olive groves of this community and burnt them and ripped up the trees to destroy their livelihood. And he said when he saw that, he thought his village would be next. So he got himself, 10 children, his wife, 4 horses, and moved to the border, and here he is now.
How long do you expect Turkey to keep its borders open?
Well, the Turks are being extremely welcoming to these people. They are providing shelter, food, medical attention. And the Prime Minister has made it quite clear. He said that what Syria has done is an atrocity and these people will be able to come for as long as they keep coming. And I think that will be quite a long time because the violence is going on. This is only the villages they've done so far around Jisr al-Shakur. They're now apparently just at the gates of the city. There are people leaving in increasing numbers, I would say. So I think they will be coming in large numbers and they will be staying quite a long time.
That's BBC reporter Owen Bennett-Jones on the border of Turkey and Syria. Owen, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Syria, Yemen, calls for revolution echo through the Middle East. Yet one country has remained quiet through it all, Saudi Arabia. This is one of the most restrictive societies in the world, with some of the same economic problems as many of its neighbors. Yet there have been no mass protests, no Twitter takedown of the monarchy. To figure out why, I talked with Ray Takei, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Saudi Arabia has remained quiet throughout many decades of Middle East going through its tumultuous transition process for two reasons. Number one, the monarchy does enjoy some kind of a legitimacy predicated on a religious sanction. Number two, they have so much wealth that they can always offer various rewards and inducements for popular consent.
And is that what's happening now? Are they kind of buying their way into...
Well, they have announced various packages of assistance and increasing security services and so forth. So they are cognizant that the contagion of democratization may actually come to their realm, but they're being particularly cautious about that in terms of their traditional means of controlling public debate.
Is that kind of spending sustainable? And can they keep buying their way out of revolution? Can they keep buying their own security?
It may be. In a country that has a small population base, profound level of oil wealth, $500 billion or so in reserves, so they may be able to actually continue with their practice of purchasing consent.
Is it safe to say the monarchy is concerned? As King Abdullah kind of surveys his neighborhood, it's getting a little unstable.
No question about it. Saudi Arabia's security is in a particularly precarious situation. There are conflicts on all of his borders, in Bahrain, in Yemen, across the Gulf, in Iran. Some of his traditional alliances, Mubarak, is no longer there, and they're very doubtful about the reliability and credibility of the traditional American support. So this is a particular time of anxiety for the House of Saud. But there's a level of intelligence to the way they manage their affairs, so they may weather this one too as well.
So you mentioned that the House of Saud views the revolutions in the Middle East as a contagion.
Yeah.
It's a very different word than the Obama administration would use to describe it. How does this alliance continue when both partners see the revolutions in diametrically opposed ways?
Well, that's just it. We're at potentially a turning point in a 60-year relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Namely, we see the region in a profoundly different way. For the United States, as the president's speech indicated, the emergence of the popular will, the emergence of these revolutions is viewed as beneficial. Saudis, on the other hand, see these as nearly an existential threat. So we and they see the region differently, and therefore we behave in the region differently. While we want to support these democratic movements and channel them in some sort of a responsible direction, the Saudis are offering aid to Jordan and Morocco not to reform.
Or security forces to Bahrain.
Or security forces to Bahrain. So now we're essentially in cross purposes from our alliances. And that actually means that this alliance is likely to attenuate even further.
How does it change? I mean, Saudi Arabia, not just does the United States have an economic tie to that country, Saudi Arabia is a crucial partner in the war against al-Qaeda in the region, in counterterrorism efforts.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia faces three specific threats. There's a domestic threat of Islamic extremism linked to al-Qaeda. There is what is happening in Yemen and the Gulf, and there's what's happening across Iran. They're likely to cooperate with the United States on some issues and no longer cooperate on other issues. I think you see terrorism as a means of cooperating between the two countries because they both have an interest, maybe even on stabilization of Yemen. But in terms of encouraging reform in Egypt, Morocco, and elsewhere in the Middle East, they're likely to go in a different direction. And they may actually opt for a more of an independent, self-sufficient defense capabilities, which may include nuclear weapons.
What exactly does that mean? You're anticipating Saudi Arabia might develop nuclear weapon technology?
That's one of the options they're going to look at closely in terms of particularly their relationship with Pakistan, namely getting that sort of a weapon from Pakistan. And that's the direction it's going to go, as opposed to developing their own indigenous nuclear infrastructure, which they don't have at this particular point, and it'll be difficult to build it up. It'll take a long time. So it'll be the Saudi-Pakistani relationship that bears watching.
Ray Tucke is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joined me here in Washington. Ray, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.